Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we welcome 3rd District U.S. Congressman Ron Kind, a Democrat from La Crosse, for his first appearance on this program because of legislative redistricting. Congressman Kind now represents much of the 7th Congressional District. That includes areas of Stevens Point, Wisconsin Rapids, and much of central Wisconsin, areas that were previously part, again, of the 7th Congressional District. So today on Route 51, we're going to ask Mr. Kind for his priorities for these new parts of his district and for his positions on the big issues of the day in foreign policy, on the turmoil in Egypt and Syria, and domestic policy, immigration reform, implementation of the Affordable Care Act, NSA spying and civil liberties, the Farm Bill, gun control, and the president's so-called grand bargain, trading a cut in the corporate tax rate for a jobs program based on new infrastructure spending. Now, if you live in central Wisconsin, this may be your first opportunity to acquaint yourself with your new congressman. And this is your chance to talk to him directly. We are taking phone calls from our listeners at 1-800-780-9742. Again, that's 1-800-780-9742. Congressman Ron Kind, thanks so much for being with us today.
Glenn, my pleasure. It's an honor to be on Route 51, and I've been enjoying the opportunity to get into the area to know those communities and the people up there, so I look forward to it.
Wonderful. Well, now, when you first ran for Congress as a Democrat from La Crosse, did you ever think you'd be representing Stevens Point?
We have a weird way of drawing the political map in this country and including in our state. You know, it's all politicians choosing the voters, which I think is backwards. Voters should be choosing their representatives. So I've been a lifelong advocate for setting up nonpartisan judicial commissions to establish the political map so the politicians don't get to. But until that changes, you know, these things happen in a weird way, and the district was redrawn, and right now I represent about one-third new people in the 3rd Congressional District. But it's a great area. I've been getting up and meeting the people there. There's a lot of economic, exciting opportunities, and we need to keep that going forward.
You know, the purpose of redistricting or gerrymandering is to give politicians safe seats. It is alleged that the way the maps were redrawn gave Sean Duffy a safe Republican district to the north, but it also gave you a safe Democratic district in the south. Is this a good thing for democracy when we have districts where there really can't be challenges to incumbents except during a primary season?
I don't think it is, Glenn. In fact, it's a bit of a misnomer to claim that the 3rd CD is a safe Democratic seat. Now, it's still a 50-50 district. Actually, the performance changed by just one-half of 1%. Sean got most of his Republican votes from Reed Ribble's 8th district. That's how he was able to solidify more of the Republican votes than that. But I think, and the reason why I'm such an advocate for nonpartisan commissions to set up the districts is so we have more competitive districts in there. And I think it's been bad for democracy that we have too many safe seats, whether it's Democratic or Republican, because you're exactly right. Their primary concern then, come election season, is being outflanked on the far right or the far left in a primary. And that's forcing these candidates further to the right or further to the left, when I think most of the people in Wisconsin and throughout the rest of America are more in the middle of the political spectrum. And yet I feel they're being less represented today. And I think that was particularly true with how the Republican-controlled legislatures redrew the map. Most of their districts at the end of the day got whiter, older, and more conservative, when the rest of the nation, demographically, is going in the opposite direction. And so we've seen that now with the rise of the Tea Party and how uncompromising people have become here in Washington and even, I've noticed, in Madison these days. And that's unfortunate, because no democracy will survive very long without an element of compromise and give and take and working hard to find common ground.
Well, it does make it harder to get things done. Well, what are your priorities for the new parts of your district, for the people of central Wisconsin? What are the needs that you've identified?
Well, I tell you, my priority 1, 2, and 3 is jobs, jobs, jobs. It's doing everything we can to get this economy back on track, creating good-paying jobs, because a growing economy with those jobs solves a lot of problems, locally, statewide, nationally. And it's not there yet, and we've got to stay focused on it. And then beyond that, what steps can we take policy-wise to to strengthen the middle class in our country that's been squeezed over a number of years right now, and to ensure that every American has an opportunity to achieve and receive a good-paying job, a job that you can raise a family on, a quality education for yourself and for your children and grandchildren, which will mean if we remain the most innovative and competitive country in the world in the 21st century, a home to call your own, a secure and dignified retirement, access to affordable and quality health care coverage. That's kind of the bread and butter issues that when people wake up, that's what they're thinking about. How do they raise their family? Whether their child's receiving a good education? Do they have a good, secure job that's fulfilling? Do they have access to affordable health care? What does retirement look like for people today?
Well,
I think there is some common ground that if we just get back to the basics, we'd get a heck of a lot more accomplished.
On the subject of jobs, your name was mentioned last night at a celebration in Stevens Point by Skyward founder Jim King, who said that you were one of the people who helped keep that company in the state. As you know, Skyward almost had to leave Wisconsin because of a state law that essentially prevented it from doing business here.
You know, it's a classic example of homegrown, innovative company on the cutting edge, producing a great service, a great quality product in that. And from my perspective as a representative in Wisconsin, we need to be doing everything we can to support those companies and to ensure that there is an environment that's welcoming to them, that we level the playing field so that they have an ability to fairly compete within our own borders, and everything we can to encourage that they stay and grow and create more good-paying jobs. This is a company with tremendous national potential, and they're starting to reach out into other states. So there's nothing written in their rule book that requires them to stay in Wisconsin. So I thought that was a time for us to rally, including with local officials, our state representatives. I know Amy Sue Vruink and Katrina and Julie Lassa were very much at work in Madison
to get the
multi-vendor legislation accomplished.
Also the Republicans. You had Republican Scott Krug and Republican John Spiro. So we actually had something that you see very little of these days, a bipartisan approach to this issue, and they were able to get that law changed.
You know, and Glenn, that's the way it should work. I mean, we all should be able to link arms and work together for the betterment of our own communities and the people that we jointly represent and try to do what's in the best interest of our state and for our economy. And I wish there was more of that type of attitude in Washington these days and what's coming out of Congress, because no question, Congress as an institution has been underperforming, has not been living up to the expectations of the American people and with their representatives. And there's a lot that has to get cleaned up here in order for us to address the big challenges that we're facing as a nation.
Let's move to Washington. President Obama this week called for another grand bargain, this one entailing a cut in the corporate tax rate and corporate tax reform in exchange for an economic stimulus based on more funding for transportation and infrastructure projects. I'm going to play a couple of very short tapes for you, Ron. Let's listen to less than a minute of the president's remarks in Chattanooga.
How about a grand bargain for middle-class jobs? So I'm going to try offering something that serious people in both parties should be able to support. A deal that simplifies the tax code for our businesses and creates good jobs with good wages for middle-class folks who work at those businesses. Right now, everybody knows this, our tax code is so riddled with loopholes and special interest tax breaks that a lot of companies who are doing the right thing and investing in America pay 35% in their taxes. Corporations who've got fancy accountants and stash their money overseas, they pay little or nothing in taxes. That's not fair. That's not good for the economy here. So, again, here's the bottom line. I'm willing to work with Republicans on reforming our corporate tax code as long as we use the money from transitioning to a simpler tax system for a significant investment in creating middle-class jobs. That's the deal.
That's the president in Chattanooga. Now, Republicans were quick to pan that proposal. Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Karl Rove.
It's just a further left version of a widely panned plan he already proposed 2 years ago, this time with extra goodies for tax and spend liberals.
Yeah, look, this is an old proposal, and Mitch McConnell was right, dressed up with some new ribbons and bows designed to appeal to liberals, not to conservatives. In April, the president made this proposal in his budget, and it was revenue neutral. Last week, Harry Reid said, we don't need revenue neutral. We need $1 trillion in taxes. So this is not about tax reform. This is about, and about tax cuts. It's about tax increases, and there's a reason for that.
And the reason for that is, according to Karl Rove, to give the president a chance to spend more money on pet projects. So, Congressman Kind, is this latest version of the grand bargain dead on arrival in Washington?
Well, I think there's a couple of issues, very important ones, that we have to have a further national conversation about as far as where we're going. And we got to learn to walk and chew gum at the same time. There's no question we have long-term unfunded liabilities and big deficits that we've got to address and get our fiscal house in order. But there's a smart and a dumb way in doing it. One of the dumb ways is the so-called sequestration, automatic across-the-board spending reductions regardless of the consequences, which means 750,000 3- and 4-year-olds are going to get kicked out of Head Start. They're only 3 and 4 once in their life. We only have one shot at them. And to remove that opportunity from them is going to make life more difficult. 5 million seniors losing Meals on Wheels, higher education students not getting help with financial aid so they can upgrade their skills and get the education they need to compete. This is what's coming from sequestration, not to mention huge cuts in basic and applied research that can lead to new discoveries and new job opportunities in our country. But what the president also was talking about is a monstrosity of a tax code that has to get cleaned up. It's not working well. It's leaving us less competitive, our businesses large and small, and it is riddled full of special interest loopholes and deductions that typical families and small businesses can't take advantage of because they don't have a legion of lobbyists in Washington fighting for their interests. And so we do need to simplify the tax code, make it fair. But I do disagree with the president that we shouldn't just be focused on corporate tax rates. We also should be looking at the individual or the pass-through rates, too, because the majority of our businesses are structured as pass-through entities. And those are the businesses who are typically ramping up and creating more of the jobs that we need in any type of economic recovery.
So you actually support John Boehner in this area. He says that those individual tax rates should be cut for the personal rates, too, because small businesses file under those.
I do, and it should be a comprehensive approach. It's really once-in-a-generation opportunity to get into the tax code and to simplify it and clear the underbrush that's been added to it through the years. And again, the majority of the businesses, family-owned, small businesses, are passed through, and I hear from them all the time when I'm back home traveling just how complicated their tax returns and how time-consuming and the loss of efficiency and man-hours to comply with that complexity. So that's something, too, that we can't afford to ignore much longer. And yet we have to pay for it, which means looking at some of the unnecessary tax breaks that exist in the tax code that we can eliminate for the sake of trying to lower the overall rate for businesses large and small to help them be more competitive globally. Well, the rest of the world has changed when it comes to their tax rates, their corporate tax rates. We have to recognize that and help our businesses be more competitive.
The Wall Street Journal said the president's proposal was actually a corporate tax increase because the reform would raise more revenue. And again, they said so he can spend that windfall on his favorite public works projects. The Journal says any additional revenue should go to reducing the debt. Do you feel that that's the case, or do you think it's important to spend money on infrastructure as well?
Well, I think it's important that we look at the big spending categories in the federal budget with the eye towards reform and cost savings. And when you're talking about that, the two largest, in fact, the largest and fastest growing area of spending, bar none, are our health accounts, health care accounts, Medicare and Medicaid. So we've got to come back and addressing the reasons why health care costs are going up, what steps we can take to bring them down, because that would solve our long-term deficit problems with the aging population that we have. And I'm convinced that if we get the incentives aligned right and we start paying for the value or the quality of care that's given rather than the volume of services, we can get better outcomes at a much better price. And in fact, we've got healthcare providers in our own communities back home that have established models of care to show us exactly how we can do that. And if we can take that nationwide, that would be the greatest single thing we can do to get these deficits under control, because that's where the greatest spending is occurring. And then after that is the defense budget. There's so much waste and redundancy in the defense budget that we can look at and reform, from outdated weapon systems that the Pentagon is telling Congress stop appropriating money for them because they don't want them and they don't need them and it's not helping troop readiness, to weapons procurement programs that today are $300 billion over budget because of change orders and contract revisions. So this blank check that defense contractors expect from the American taxpayer has got to end. We've got to stop that. And then finally, I've been one of the leading voices ever since I arrived in Congress to reform the Farm Bill and get away from these huge taxpayer subsidies that go into big agribusiness. It doesn't make sense. It's fiscally irresponsible. It's leading to greater consolidation in production agriculture. It's not helping our family farmers back home. It's hurting new beginning farmers to enter the occupation when we need it. And there's a lot of unnecessary spending in the Farm Bill, too, that we should look to first so that we can free up some money to invest in education and job training and in research and in broadband expansion and in infrastructure modernization.
So you do think infrastructure spending is important, spending on roads, bridges, the electrical grid, research and development, because the Chinese are spending hundreds of millions of dollars in infrastructure.
Yeah, Glenn, we are becoming very close to turning into a third world nation when it comes to our own infrastructure system. I mean, if you fly into Shanghai airport today, it is state of the art. It is first class. And unfortunately, you go through most major airports here in the United States, and it's a bit embarrassing to see what kind of condition they're in. So, yeah, we are long overdue for a reinvestment in our nation's infrastructure so we can support the type of economic growth that's needed to create the jobs here at home. And it's not getting done. And it's not getting done because of a prevailing philosophy of just cut here, cut now, cut everything, regardless of the consequences. And if that continues, we're setting the next generation up for failure. We're not laying the table for them to be successful and for them to be able to compete in a increasingly competitive global environment that we find ourselves in today.
We have a listener who posted on our Facebook page, our Route 51 Facebook page, who hopes that you continue to support Amtrak funding.
Yeah, I think it's important that there is option for public transportation in this country. Amtrak, there are lines that are more efficient than others, but every other industrial nation in the world offers public transport systems, including rail, and we should not turn our back on that opportunity, too. It's important to maintain diversified options when it comes to the transportation needs, whether business or personal, and especially in areas like the upper Midwest. I was very disappointed that the governor decided to turn down the high-speed rail money. That money will be spent in our neighboring states, and it will bypass Wisconsin, creating an economic island for us because the businesses wanted this. They wanted that interconnectivity in the upper Midwest, and I think Governor Walker lacked the vision to see how this was going to connect the region and therefore spur economic growth and job creation at the same time.
How hurtful have the sequestration cuts and the furloughs been to Fort McCoy, Volk Field, and Camp Williams, all of which are in your district?
Yeah, it's funny you mention that because just Monday I was in Sparta at the American Legion and had a meeting with those families that are being asked to take this forced furlough. 1,500 at Fort McCoy, roughly 200 at Volk Field, 60 more Camp Douglas there, as you pointed out. And it's very unfortunate because it's so unfair. These families didn't cause the budget deficit, and yet they're being asked to take a 20% pay cut, and many of them are living paycheck to paycheck. Some of them were telling me they're fearful now of losing their homes because they're not going to be able to maintain their mortgage payments. And then when they have less disposable income in their pocket, that's going to affect the main streets in our communities, and it is going to have an adverse economic impact on our regional economy. And then I heard a lot, too, from the personnel from the military bases of how that work that normally gets done is being delayed or backlogged. And this is starting to affect training and readiness drills out at Fort McCoy in particular, which makes it dangerous then because if we're underperforming when it comes to the training of our troops, then that becomes an easy target during the next BRAC round of what military bases should be shut down and eliminated. And the economic impact of these military bases in our region cannot be overstated. It is tremendous. So, you know, for the sake of fairness and for common sense, we need to go back and fix that so-called sequestration. I've called it Latin for stupid spending cuts because that's what it is. It's across the board, it's indiscriminate, and it's leading to very bad consequences that are going to hurt economic growth.
Congressman Ron Kind, 3rd District Congressman, Democrat from La Crosse, who now represents much of central Wisconsin because of redistricting, much of the Stevens Point area. If you would like to, if you're listening from that area, if you'd like to talk to your new congressman, if you've got questions about federal policy, regardless of where you're listening, give us a phone call. Our lines are wide open right now at 1-800-780-9742. What are your priorities for the federal government? What do you think we're doing right? What do you think we're doing wrong? Do you think taxes are too high? Do you think spending is too low? 1-800-780-9742. Or you can leave us a message on our Facebook page, the Route 51 Facebook page, and we will pass it along. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We'll be back to talk about health care after this.
Support for WPR comes from Wausau's Woodson Art Museum, presenting Celebrating Summer, an exhibition of on-location paintings by plein air painters of America, illustrating the beauty of summer now through August 25th. More at lywam.org.
I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. If you just joined us, we are talking to 3rd District Congressman Ron Kind, who now represents much of central Wisconsin. Ron, let's talk a little bit about foreign policy, because if we don't talk about it now, we're probably not going to get to it. We've got so much on our domestic agenda. Should there be more hearings on Benghazi? Some Republicans actually want a special prosecutor or investigator appointed.
You know, we've had a lot of hearings on Benghazi, and so far there was nothing there. I mean, it was a very difficult situation and very unfortunate. And Ambassador Stevens and others lost their lives there. But they've been digging, and they've been probing, trying to find some type of scandal or conspiracy, and nothing is there. So we can continue to waste our time trying to go down that road. And it's not just Benghazi. There are endless other investigations with the White House, too. And listen, if there was some evidence, some factual basis for these investigations to move forward, then sign me up. I'm all. But if it's just going to turn into a political witch hunt or an attempt to try to undermine Secretary Clinton in case she does run for president in 2016, well, there are more important pressing issues that affect people's lives back home than these endless, nonstop, open-ended investigations, hoping to find something that doesn't exist.
Spying by the National Security Agency has been defended as an important safeguard against terrorism, but the idea that phone records are being gathered indiscriminately is frightening to many Americans. For the first time, there's a public opinion poll indicating more Americans are interested in protecting civil liberties than in protecting the country from a terrorist attack. Do you think the National Security Agency has overstepped its bounds?
Well, I'm glad we're having this enhanced scrutiny in this debate. I think it's important. And I think it's also important that whenever we're asking our intelligence gathering agencies to collect certain information to prevent attacks on the United States, all three branches need to be involved with effective oversight and acting as checks and balances to ensure that no branch is overreaching. And in this case, it's the executive branch and the intelligence agencies in the executive branch that the Congress and the courts need to keep a close eye on. That means Congress is going to have to step up our oversight capability to ensure it is complying with the Constitution, to ensure that the information that's being gathered is necessary in order to do a better job of safeguarding Americans here. And the so-called FISA court, the federal court, needs to also be doing a good job of screening these applications for search warrants, for information gathering, for wiretaps, things of that nature. And Glenn, I'm a former prosecutor and former special prosecutor in Wisconsin, and I went before a single judge all the time to get search warrants, to get wiretaps, and I had to show a probable cause for it. And during the years when I was doing that, I was never denied that, because it's a low threshold of proof. And the same is true in the FISA court, too. And that's why there hasn't been many denials, I think 11 total so far. But it's important that there's that judicial oversight, again, to act as a check against any overreach. And then finally, the executive branch has a constitutional obligation to comply with the Constitution. So just because they're in charge of administering these programs doesn't mean they get to ignore the Fourth Amendment or the Constitution in doing so. But I also think that what the NSA has been asked to do is important, and it has been successful. We're literally asking them to find the proverbial needle in the haystack and then connect the dots. We didn't have that capability before September 11th, and we suffered as a consequence. Now we do have that technology. And what they are gathering is phone calls that are placed, time, date, location, but not the name or not the content of the conversation.
You're okay with that?
And I'm comfortable with that as long as Congress and FISA is doing our jobs, too, and that's keeping a close watch on the program, which is happening.
Comment on the allegations that the IRS targeted conservative groups.
Well, that falls in my committee's jurisdiction of Ways and Means, and we have had endless hearings on that as well. And the Inspector General's office that did the report was clear in his findings that they didn't find any political motivation at all between these IRS employees and the Cincinnati office. And in fact, one of the employees that was in charge of the program is a self-stated conservative Republican. And he said there was no political bias that was being applied. One of the reasons so many conservative groups were being scrutinized because there was an explosion of these conservative organizations after the Citizens United case that was applying for the so-called 501c4 status, tax-exempt status.
Should tax-free status be given to any group, conservative or liberal, that engages in political activity? Didn't the original law back in the 50s say that tax-free status only went to groups that were exclusively engaged in social welfare?
It was, and that has been the problem that the IRS has run into, is this ill-defined wording now that they have to operate under, and it leads to very subjective judgments. And when you set an agency up to make those subjective judgments, mistakes are going to be made. And I think we do need clear, bright-line rules in this regard, and I would love to take us back to the original language, which was very bright-line, and that is they had to be exclusively engaged in social welfare activities and no political activities. But also, just to back up a little bit, Glenn, also evidence has come out showing that the IRS was also targeting some progressive groups, the Move On activities, the other ones too, and they were chosen for enhanced scrutiny. And I think that's what the IRS should be doing. I mean, if you're applying for tax exempt status, then you've got to meet the definition that you're primarily engaged in social welfare. And a lot of these groups, let's admit it right now, were primarily formed and they're primarily engaged in political activities. And if you're involved in political activities, you should not qualify for tax-exempt status. So I think Congress needs to go back to that original statute and clean it up so that the IRS is given clear guidelines that they can follow that takes the human judgment out of this.
1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to talk to Congressman Ron Kind. 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to Blade in Wautoma, who's got a question about the different priorities of rural and urban parts of America. Blade?
Hi, Glenn, Congressman. Thank you for taking my call. Milwaukee is home, but I've been spending a lot of time in Wautoma working up here. I'm going to for quite some time. And yesterday on one of the other WPR shows, they brought up, is there a lot of divide between the rural parts of the state and the more metropolitan parts of the state? And my own personal experience, I've noticed that being up here in Wautoma, I definitely see the elements of social conservatism, but I definitely see a strong sense of community. And in a lot of areas in Milwaukee, you definitely have the same feeling where I was with Bayview, St. Francis, what have you. But also, I do, at least in Wautoma, see a lot of pockets of liberalism. I remember when they had the recall a few years ago, I saw a lot of Fred Clarks over the place. So I think it's definitely there, and I think the similarities, you know, outweigh the differences.
So Blade, your question for the congressman.
And I guess my question is, I guess what would be the congressman's thoughts on this? Does he see something similar, or does he have a different?
All right, Blade, thanks so much. You're breaking up a little bit. We're going to let the congressman take the question off air. And Congressman Kind, you've got a very rural district, but you do have some urban pockets in it.
Yeah, and I think it's a great issue that Blade's raising, too, because I've always approached these issues that we have more alike than differences in this country as Americans, as opposed to urban, rural, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal. Sometimes these labels kind of bog us down and put people in separate corners unnecessarily. But at the end of the day, I mean, we all share common aspirations and interests of having that secure job to raise a family, access to quality education, access to quality health care that's affordable, worries about our retirement security, too. Those are things that bind us as a nation. So if we can continue to focus on the common ground, the common issues that do unite us, maybe we can get past a lot of the political disputes and the polarization that has come to paralyze our political system today.
We touched on health care, and let's get into it in a little more detail. The House, I think, is ready to take, what, its 40th vote to repeal Obamacare, and there are even lawmakers who say they want to shut down the government in order to take its funding away. Is that going to happen?
Well, it won't happen because clearly the president wouldn't sign any legislation, and the Senate obviously wouldn't take it up to begin with. But the larger point is this. I supported the Affordable Care Act not because I believed it was a perfect bill, but I was convinced that the status quo was taking us to a very bad place in this country. If we did nothing to try to reform the health care system, we knew what was going to happen, and it was a certainty. Costs would continue to rise. There would be more uninsured people in Wisconsin and throughout the country. Our businesses, large and small, would be less competitive globally because of the rising health care costs that they're bearing. And our public budget deficits were going to continue to explode because, again, health care costs is the fastest growing area of spending.
Now, those arguments have been made over and over, but polls show still that a majority of Americans don't like the Affordable Care Act. Why is that?
Well, I think there's been a tremendous amount of money spent on misinformation, disinformation, and trying to undermine the Affordable Care Act and what it's really all about. I mean, you remember the death panel shrill out there. There are no death panels in this. A government-run health care system. There's no government-run health care in these exchanges. There are a bunch of private insurance health plans competing for individuals and small businesses and now, creating competition where it didn't exist before. So there's been a tremendous effort to undermine the purpose of the law. Now, I'm not going to sit here today, Glenn, and try to convince listeners that it is a perfect piece of legislation. It's an attempt to try to reform a system that was in desperate need of reform, but we have to have the wisdom to be patient, to see what's working and what isn't working, and make changes and adjustments along the way. That's the only way this can work, and it's the only way you can really reform a healthcare system the right way. And I'd like to see the Congress come together more to find out what is working and what changes have to continue to be made, and get to work on that rather than having this stale political debate 40 times over to try to repeal something that clearly is not going to be repealed now that the Supreme Court has weighed in on the issue, too.
Now part of the Affordable Care Act was the additional Medicaid money for states. You criticized Governor Walker for refusing that money, calling it, and this is a quote from you, budgetary and fiscal malpractice. Why did you say that?
Well, because this is the best offer that states are going to get from the federal government to help them expand, in our case, the Badger Care program. This program is targeted to the toughest people to get health care coverage for, low income, those with some chronic illnesses, and especially children, getting them into a proper health insurance coverage. And it was all going to be paid for the first three years at the federal level, and then 90% from there on in. But one of the misnomers about the Affordable Care Act, Glenn, is it's this huge budget buster. But we made sure that when we passed the legislation, it all had to be paid for through spending reductions or some additional revenue to ensure that it wasn't going to add to the deficit.
And
the Congressional Budget Office, when they analyzed the bill, said it will reduce our budget deficits by $1.2 trillion over the next 20 years.
I want to get back to this Medicaid money. Last night, I had a chance to talk to Governor Walker. Here's what he said about Medicaid coverage in Wisconsin, even with him refusing the federal money.
In our case, for the first time in the state's history, unlike my predecessor, Jim Doyle, I will cover every person living in poverty with Medicaid. In the past, there was a cap which put people on the waiting list. So going forward, everyone living in Medicaid will be, or excuse me, everyone living in poverty will be covering under Medicaid. Our budget plan reduces the number of people uninsured while reducing the number of people on Medicaid by transitioning people into the marketplace. And we think that's a good option. I think it's one of the options that governors across the country will look at and say, if they hadn't done it, they wish they would have done it.
Ron Kind, your reaction to the governor's statement?
Well, it's kind of funny because all the information we got back is with the governor's decision, it will increase the uninsured in Wisconsin by 125,000 people. It will increase taxes on small businesses by about $64 million because of his rejection of the federal offer. But don't listen to me. I mean, he can just listen to his fellow Republican governors that are embracing this offer to expand Medicaid in their states, from Governor Brewer in Arizona to Governor Kasich, Governor Scott, Governor Christie, right down the line. So they are looking at this for what it is, and it's too good a deal to pass up. But with him passing it up now, it puts Wisconsin in a very tough position. And it was the health care providers, it was the business community back home in Wisconsin that were encouraging Governor Walker to accept it. And don't be foolish just for his own political ambition, in case he's running for president in 2016, to reject it. And his reason for rejecting it didn't make sense, Glenn. He said, well, he wasn't sure if the money would continue to be there in future years for this expansion.
Well,
and yet
the...
he's comfortable in pushing all these people now into the health insurance exchanges that will be dependent on premium tax credits to afford their health care coverage. So if he was worried about the Medicaid money being there, he should equally be worried about the tax credit being there for people, too. So we can't have it both ways in this argument.
Why delay the implementation of coverage through the employer mandate? A recent report by the Congressional Budget Office indicates that 500,000 Americans will lose their promised coverage because of the president's delay in enforcing that part of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, 95% of the businesses are already providing health care coverage that this would affect. And the president, to his credit and his administration's credit, took time to listen to them. And what they heard was, listen, we can't do it. They didn't hear we can't do it. They said we just need some additional time to put the systems in place so we can properly report what you're asking us to report. And the president said, all right, I hear that, so we're just going to delay implementation and give you the time that you need, which I think is a very pragmatic, very reasonable. And, again, it gets me back to my original point that we need to be making adjustments as we go forward so we don't create an entire mess of the system. And so I credit the president for taking time to listen to these businesses who are saying, we just need some additional time. And of the 500,000 that you cited, these were people who unfortunately weren't getting that coverage through their through an employer-sponsored plan.
If you're delaying the employer mandate, doesn't it make sense to also delay the individual mandate?
No, because if you do that, then you risk seeing these premiums skyrocket in the health insurance exchanges. The key to any insurance is the ability to spread the risk. And if you delay the individual mandate, then you take the incentive away for the young and healthy to enter the exchange and get affordable coverage. And that's really going to be the key to keep the premium prices affordable for everyone participating in the exchange. And I know my Republican colleagues would love nothing better than to try to delay that other aspect of it, but because they know that if you delay that, then the insurance premiums are going to skyrocket. And it will become very unaffordable for those who are in the insurance market, because those are typically going to be people with pre-existing conditions or with some health care needs that can't get it right now. All that changes on January 1st, that if you have a pre-existing condition, you can no longer be denied health care coverage. And I can't tell you how many people have come up who have told me what a relief it is that that has happened. But in order for that to happen, you also need the young and healthy to be in that insurance pool so you can spread the risk. And if you delay the individual mandate, you lose that aspect. But now, as we're finding from the states that are moving forward and creating their own health insurance exchanges, that the premium rates being reported are 20, 30, 50% below what they're currently paying today. And that's because of the increased competition that these exchanges are creating. And that's even before these premium tax credits would go to these individuals so they can even further afford health care coverage. And I'm just it's unfortunate, again, that Governor Walker decided to punt in creating our own health insurance exchange in Wisconsin, because I know we could have done it. We could have done it very well ourselves. We could have done it the Badger way and showed the rest of the country how well an exchange can be set up. But instead, Governor Walker chose not to participate. And that means the Department of Health and Human Service now will have to come in and do it for us in Wisconsin. And I think it's just another missed opportunity that the governor did.
Ron Kind, you have been pointed to as a possible future candidate for governor for the Democrats. Do you have any intention of ever running for governor in this state?
Well, right now I've got a full plate, Glenn, and getting to know a new district that I've been enjoying. But I'm right in the middle of trying to implement the health care reform bill the right way, not the wrong way. We're in the middle of comprehensive tax reform. But I also have two teenage boys living at home, and there are serious family considerations that you have to make too when you're thinking about that. And I'm trying to be the best father and best husband I can be too, while balancing the other responsibilities that I have.
So you're saying right now, but you're not saying never.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would completely close the door. A lot of politics is being in the right place at the right time, and also having that fire in your belly and knowing that you have something to offer the people back home.
Congressman Ron Kind. He represents the 3rd Congressional District, which is now representing much of central Wisconsin, including Stevens Point. We've got a link to the Congressman's House website on our Facebook page, Route 51 Show. If you would like to talk to the Congressman, if you've got any concerns about federal policy, foreign or domestic, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Congressman, the House couldn't pass immigration reform, even though a bipartisan bill sailed through the Senate. Comment on that.
Well, it's not over yet. The House has yet to bring up any immigration legislation this year. Speaker Boehner said he's hoping to get it on the calendar in the fall. There's a lot of work that's going into it, but again, you're talking about a very dysfunctional immigration system in this country that's hurting economic growth, it's hurting job creation, it hasn't been fair. I've heard from a lot of businesses who say we need to do a better job with E-Verify, but I also hear from a lot of dairy farmers who say they need help on the farm in order to keep the milking operation functioning. So I'm hoping that with the Senate lead, and they did pass a comprehensive immigration reform bill with strong bipartisan support, but there'll be enhanced pressure now on the House to do something comparable this fall. And only time will tell. But it's a problem that's not going to solve itself, and it's not going to go away. And, in fact, over 50% of the undocumented people in our country today actually entered this country legally through legal visas, legal green cards that expired. And then we lose track of them. So we've got to improve the tracking system, too, in this country.
Congressman Sean Duffy says he favors an approach to immigration that would allow undocumented immigrants to stay in America and work here without fear of being deported, but he would not grant them the rights of citizens or the right to vote. Comment on that idea.
I just think second-class citizenship, in retrospect, throughout the history of our country, hasn't worked well. You create subsets or categories. And every time we've done that, we tend to look back on it with great regret, whether it was our treatment of African-Americans during slavery in our country, or our treatment of Chinese laborers who built our railroads, or how we treated Japanese during the Second World War, and right down the list. We've always looked back on it with regret. So I think if we're going to create the right incentives, there has to be ultimately some earned pathway to citizenship, but it's got to be earned. There's got to be a lot of ask and a lot of things that they've got to do, recognizing first and foremost they broke our law, and they got to pay a penalty for doing it. They got to get at the end of the line so they're not leapfrogging over anyone who is doing this by legal means the way it should be doing. Got to learn English. They got to stay out of trouble. And if they fail in any of those, then they're going to be deported. But there's got to be an earned pathway at the end of the day, or it's going to be very difficult to get comprehensive reform accomplished.
Republicans are worried that if you have more Hispanics in this country who can vote, that's more votes for Democrats. I mean, look at what happened in the last election.
Man, I hope we don't reach the point in our politics that all issues are done through the prism of the next election and where the vote, how this is going to affect votes and voter turnout, because then we are going to create a mess in this democracy of ours. I hope that we're able to, as rational human beings, come together, listen to each other, focus on the best interests of our nation at large, and then work hard to find that common ground to get things done. But if all we're doing is just looking to the next election and how this is going to affect turnout and support, then we're in a world of hurt, I think.
The president, over the past few weeks, has mentioned climate change a few times and went so far as to say this is an important global problem. We can't wait. These are his words for a meeting of the Flat Earth Society. Any chance of any climate change legislation passing in the House of Representatives, and would Ron Kind support it?
Well, I would, because I think it's necessary, and I think the science is clear, and it's been clear for a long time. But unfortunately, so many of my colleagues have denied the science. They reject it. They don't accept it. And if you can't at least agree on the facts or the science, then how are you going to come up with a reasonable solution at the end of the day? So maybe there's a way of recouching this in different terms and get away from the whole global warming and climate change argument, and let's do what makes sense anyway. Let's increase energy efficiency standards for buildings and homes and appliances in our vehicles, because that's going to save us money ultimately in the long term. Let's continue to develop alternative and renewable energy sources that don't emit as much CO2 in the atmosphere, because the longer we stay dependent on oil, that's a depleting resource. Now, we've had this fracking boom right now, but that's temporary. That's not something that you're going to be able to sustain our economy on. So there's other incentives to do what ultimately needs to be done to address climate change, but for other reasons as well.
Well, let's look into fracking. What's your position on fracking for natural gas exploration? Advocates say natural gas is less polluting, creates less carbon dioxide than burning coal, but frack sand mines have proliferated in the 3rd Congressional District. They're getting a lot of opposition from environmentalists.
Well, they are, and I think there is a need for increased scrutiny and review, especially the impact on groundwater supplies. I know I've met with a lot of groups back home who are worried about the tapping of that groundwater and the potential contamination of it, too. And let's face it, no community is going to be able to survive very long unless you have access to quality, reliable water to sustain yourself. And I think things have moved so quickly that we need to step up oversight and do the research that's necessary to ensure that it's being done in a safe and sustainable manner. And I think a lot of people are not convinced that that is what is happening. But the additional concern I have is with such a quick build-out of all the frac sand mines in our area, if there's a drop in market price, and that has come down recently, you get a lot of the perhaps younger companies that are going to go out of business. And so I'm worried about the reclamation plans, too, and whether ultimately they're going to be adhered to in the future. But I've also noticed a lot of our county boards have done a lot of work to try to work with the zoning and the application process to try to do this in a sustainable fashion.
Do it in a way that's not going to harm the neighbors or adjacent property owners. We've only got a few minutes here, and I want to hit a couple of areas real quickly. First of all, gun control. In the wake of the shootings at Sandy Hook in Aurora, Colorado, and the incident that injured Representative Gabby Giffords, there's been calls to toughen background checks for gun buyers and eliminate the so-called gun show loophole. But gun rights are very important in rural America and in a lot of your districts. So where do you come down on this? Do you think we should tighten background checks?
Well, listen, I've been a strong defender of Second Amendment rights. I love to hunt and fish myself. But as a former prosecutor and as a father, too, I think there are some common sense, reasonable measures to enhance societal safety when it comes to gun violence in our communities. And again, as a former prosecutor, it has never made any sense not to call for a universal background check. If the goal is to try to prevent those guns from entering the wrong people's hands to begin with, the only way you can accomplish that is through a basic background check. And a couple of months ago, I took my two boys to a National Turkey Federation banquet, as we like to do, and as chance would have it, I through a raffle, won a shotgun. And so I went up and I filled out my application sheet, my background check sheet. It took me about a minute to do. They called it in, and within 2 minutes, response came back that I'm good to go, and I was able to walk out with that shotgun. It is a extremely minimal burden that we're asking people to do, and most of the gun owners and hunters that I know in my life don't think it's an unreasonable request to be made.
All
but
right.
Again, it's another issue that has become so politicized and so polarized. It's hard to find common ground on this.
All right, Ron Kind, we have exactly 1 minute left, so I'm going to let you bring up anything you want to, although the question I had involved your opposition to the current proposal for student loan rates.
Well, the reason I opposed it was because at the end of the day, we're going to be raising over $1 billion off the backs of these students through increased interest rates, which I think is morally wrong and indefensible, given the huge debt that they're accumulating on their own. I just introduced legislation I was hoping to make an order that says any money that we're making off from these student loans has to go back into the financial aid programs, or Pell Grants in particular, so that these students are not helping to pay for our deficit. I just think it's wrong that we're driving them further and further in debt. And now, with this legislation, we're going to be earning money off them, too, while they're taking on this debt that will probably follow them through most of their life. And that's going to hurt, again, economic growth if this continues.
Ron Kind, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate you taking the time, and welcome to Central Wisconsin.
Great. Thanks, Glenn. I enjoyed it. Look forward to the next time.
Congressman Ron Kind, 3rd District U.S. Congressman, who is now representing parts of the former 7th Congressional District in Stevens Point and the Wisconsin Rapids area. Thanks to our executive producer and also our on-air producer, Rick Ryer, today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Now, if you missed part of this program, a reminder that Route 51 is now rebroadcast every Friday evening at 7 o'clock on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. Our stations, WLBL 91.9 FM Wausau, 930 AM Auburndale Stevens Point, WHBM 90.3 FM Park Falls, 89.1 FM Adams Wisconsin Rapids, 90.9 FM High Definition Channel 3, and now our newest station, 89.9 FM Rhinelander Eagle River. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.